from KQED.
The California dream is slipping away. Our unemployment rate is higher than 12%. There are state budget deficits as far as the eye can see. And opinion surveys show record low confidence in our elected officials.
We have a perfect storm of conditions in California that have combined to make the state absolutely ungovernable.
There are calls to overhaul state government, but can California reinvent itself, or have we run out of time for creative solutions?
The great thing about California's innovation over the years is it's made us optimists. We're always convinced that the next great thing is right around the next corner. The downside of that optimism is it makes us procrastinate.
Coming up, a roundtable discussion of California governance, what's broken, and how to start fixing it. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. California faces another $21 billion budget deficit over the next 18 months, coming just a few months after the state solved a $26 billion deficit. Surveys by the Public Policy Institute of California and others show trust in government is at record low levels. And there's a sense that we need fundamental reform or change in the state. On December 4th of 2009, we brought together eight people who've been thinking about these issues for an informal conversation at KQED Studios in San Francisco. Over the next hour, you'll hear excerpts from that conversation. Our guests are Professor Jule Taylor Gibbs of UC Berkeley's School of Social Welfare, Mark Baldessari, president of the Public Policy Institute of California, Joel Fox, president of the Small Business Action Committee and editor of the conservative website Fox and Hounds Daily, former State Senator Jim Brulte, a Republican who represented the Inland Empire, Dr. Sandra Hernandez, CEO of the San Francisco Foundation, Bob Hertzberg, co-chair of California Forward and a Democrat who was Speaker of the Assembly representing Los Angeles, Dan Schnur of USC's Jess Unruh Institute of Politics, and Matt Reagan, the Vice President of Government Relations for the Bay Area Council. I began by asking how we got to a point where so many people are questioning whether the state of California is fundamentally ungovernable. The first response is from Bob Hertzberg.
You know, California is a place of great innovation. Here in San Francisco in 1849, the gold rush, the boom and bust nature of California has been our brand and our genius, which has attracted the imagination of the world. Part of it is the beauty and what God has given us in California, but part of it is it's just the folks from around this table and our families and where we've come from to all be here in California. And that has been somewhat historically a boom and bust, number one. Number two is, you know, look, I mean, California's been wildly successful. We're the biggest and most powerful state in a thousand ways. We've got challenges, but I would argue that there's kind of two overarching dynamics. First, just the rate of change. Look at your BlackBerry or your Google in the last 10 years of how the world's changed. And globalization, when you're trying to be at the cutting edge of innovation and creativity and you're trying to manage that and create the wealth that we need to create to be California is a very difficult challenge, and our generation has that great responsibility. Second, is that because the place is so big and so disparate, it's been hard to really have a leadership class, if you will, that looks out for the common good. What we've seen is a dynamic, whether it's been at every level, it's not just the me generation, but it's what's in it for me. These initiatives we're seeing, it's all protecting people's interests and grabbing what they can grab. And there's not this level, I see it as we're engaged in California Forward, of folks that are taking and looking like PPIC is doing, one of the rare examples of what's California look like in 2025 and what do we got to do to get there? And you just don't see that out there. And that's the biggest challenge we face, because I think if you had smart folks sitting around the room to do that, you'd move the ball around the table a lot
faster. So are you saying it's a lack of good leadership?
Yeah, but it's not just political leadership. It's broader leadership. It's everybody focused on their own issues of the day. Corporations who send in regional managers whose job it is to keep the natives down, spread out a few dollars of gold and take the money back to the crown, so to speak, and not engage in the civic debate and civic culture of the community. San Francisco has some old families, longtime families that are still very much a part of what made San Francisco so great and built San Francisco from the palace to go look at all the institutions. You look around California and who are those people? What is and it's missing, and yet you have this tremendous growth to capture these markets.
Dan Schnur, you've been involved in getting leaders elected in California for a while now. Do you see a change in the quality of the leadership in California at the state and local level?
I do see a change in the quality of the leadership. And before I join the rush to condemn the current generation of political leaders from both parties at all levels, I'd argue that that's more a matter of circumstance,
right,
than anything else. And Bob and I think began the appropriate conversation on why those circumstances have changed. I guess I'd offer a couple thoughts on this front, Scott. Number one, you know, my favorite quote is Wallace Stegner. He says, "California is America, only more so." And usually that means we're better than everyone else. When it comes to these twin deficits, one of finance and one of trust, we're worse or more intense than everyone else. So the problems we're talking about here today might be more extreme in California, but they're not unique to California. You see them in national politics and you see them in state politics around the country as well. And I think that's for two main reasons, which leads to the dearth of leadership that your question alluded to. One is you have a hyper-partisanship of politics. Some of that is a matter of political strategy. Smart people in the two major parties have realized it's a lot easier, a lot more cost-efficient to mobilize your base than it is to persuade undecided voters in the middle. Some of it's a nature of technology, and perhaps we can talk about that later. Some of it's just natural human instinct. We're the most mobile society in history, mm-hmm. and because we're mobile, we have more control over where we live and who we live with or near to, and we tend to live with people like us, whether it's people who are similar to us in terms of race or ethnicity or in terms of ideology or in terms of income. We tend to self-separate. And so when it comes time for a candidate for governor to ask people to come together on behalf of a state that's largely an abstract to them, it's not their natural tendency to think of a state of 37 million people. They think of their own enclave. They think of their own cul-de-sac. And the challenge for leaders is to be able to overcome those parochial concerns, and I think that's the biggest difficulty. Real quick, and then I'll shut up, is the other real challenge in terms of leadership is the downside of the boom and bust cycle that Bob was talking about. The great thing about California's innovation over the years is it's made us optimists. We're always convinced that the next great thing is right around the next corner. The downside of that optimism is it makes us procrastinate. And so what's happened over many years, back to your original question to Joel Fox, is what has happened in state government? Our elected leaders of both parties have decided that if we just put off the day of reckoning long enough, mm-hmm. Silicon Valley or someone will do something really, really lucrative and bail us out of it. So optimism is great, but it means putting off difficult decisions until the situation gets better.
And what I hear you and Bob Hertzberg saying, though, is that maybe the problems aren't as bad, at least I think you said, not as bad as we think, because this, everyone in the country, all states are struggling with money and financial issues right now. We just are, because we were hit a little harder maybe than most states, that we're going to be in it a little longer, it's going to go a little deeper, but that we will come out of it. Or Jim Brodeur, do you agree with that? Is it just kind of one of the cycles and we just need to ride it out? Or is there something structural and fundamental about California that does make us different from other states to our detriment?
Well, I do think some of it's cyclical and some of it's structural. When I was a kid, California was the last state in America to go in a recession, and we were the first to come out. Today, we're the first in, and we're going to be the last out. So that's a fundamental dynamic change, and that probably has more to do with what I think is the problem. One of the core problems is that, you know, we're not very friendly to people who create wealth and create jobs. I mean, the budget deficit isn't the problem. It's a symptom of a structural problem. That's point number one. I think that's exacerbated by the hyper-partisanship that Dan referred to, but I think there's a structural dysfunction in California government, and let me just give you about a minute on this. You know, from 1932 to 1964, we had non-ideological political parties, you know, conservative Democrats, liberal Democrats, conservative Republicans. With the 1964 election, we moved away from class politics towards ideological politics. And so today we have ideological parties. You know, when I was a kid, they used to say there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties. You can't say that today. I'm a part of the conservative party. Bobby is part of the liberal party. So you have ideological parties. When I ran for the legislature in 1990, 10% of the electorate was declined to state. Today it's 20%. And who are they? They're moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats who looked at the left wing of his party and the right wing of my party, and they left. So what happens when you take ideological parties and you take part of the center out? You exacerbate the dysfunction. I mean, there is no advantage for a Democrat in the legislature to work with a Republican. There's no advantage for a Republican in the legislature to work with a Democrat because the base of your parties will punish you. It's also exacerbated by the fact that we have term limits. If I said only Nixon could go to China, about half the people in this room who are somewhat near my age would know what I meant. 20 years as an anti-communist. So when he did something as counterintuitive as saying he was going to go to Red China, conservatives like my dad, I can remember this as if it were yesterday, he said, you know, I don't like this. I don't understand it. But I trust Richard Nixon, and I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. When you're in the assembly for 4 years, you're not there long enough to establish your bona fides with your core constituencies to ever be able to tell your core constituencies no. So when I was the legislative leader, special interests needed me. Well, today the legislative leaders need the special interest. And that gets exacerbated by the campaign finance reform we have in this state, where you can give me $3,900 if I'm running for the assembly, but you can give $3 million to an independent expenditure committee and make sure I never win anything. So you've created this structural impediment to finding bipartisan solutions. It was not accidental that Gray Davis, an instinctively moderate Democrat, governor of this state, had trouble with the legislative wing of his party, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, an instinctively moderate Republican, has trouble with the legislative wing of his party. And whoever the next governor is, we're going to have it until we deal with that structural impediment. That's why the Republicans don't raise taxes. That's why the Democrats don't cut spending. And that's why we are probably $200-300 billion in debt when you factor in the public employee pension systems, the structural deficit, the health benefit system that is actuarially unsound. And now I just read that the unemployment fund is only about $7.5 billion short. So it's structural, and it's not going to change until you change the structure of how we do things.
I don't want to get too deeply right this second into term limits, but term limits, support for term limits, was kind of part of the Republican orthodoxy.
Sure.
For a while, and you were a supporter of term limits.
I am a supporter of term limits.
You still do?
Sure, absolutely. But at the time I said I don't think 6 years in the assembly is enough. I actually supported Prop 93. Look, this next November, someone, and I'm going to use Democrats because they're going to be the majority. It'd be bad if it were Republicans, a little bit worse if it's Democrats. But some Democrat's going to be elected in November of next year. He or she is going to get sworn in December, go to Hertzberg-Leonard University, which is 3 days of how to be a legislator.
10 days.
10 days now? Congratulations. With budget cuts, it may be down to three, Bobby. Going to go home for Christmas. He or she is going to come back to Sacramento. And in February, before that new member of the legislature even knows that there's an ATM machine in the basement where they can get some cash, they're going to be presiding over budget subcommittees determining where tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money is spent. And I will tell you, they will have no idea what they're doing. No matter how smart they are, they'll have no idea. And that's what term limits has brought. So I'm not against term limits. I mean, I love Willie Brown. I didn't think he should be in government for 30 years. But, you know, that's all right. But 6 years is not enough to learn a state that is incredibly complex.
That was former State Senator Jim Brulte. And earlier in that segment, we heard from former Assembly Speaker Bob Hertzberg and Dan Schnur of USC, a former Republican political consultant. Many of the participants in our roundtable identified special interest groups as part of the problem, but they also realized that one person's special interest is another person's core constituency. In this excerpt, we'll hear from sociologist Jewel Taylor Gibbs, pollster Mark Baldessari, conservative activist Joel Fox, Sandra Hernandez of the San Francisco Foundation, and to begin, Matt Reagan of the Bay Area Council.
We are a special interest like every other group that goes to Sacramento, and more often than not, we don't feel particularly special in Sacramento. A recent survey by CEO Magazine cited California as the worst state in the union to start a business and the worst state in the union to run a business, and it's primarily due to taxation and regulation. But the Bay Area Council, we are not a business association that focuses on core business regulation taxation type issues. We bring a business voice to larger public policy issues such as water, education, healthcare, land use, and transportation. And the reason why we have involved ourselves in this whole government reform conversation is because when we go to Sacramento and we try to have a conversation about water or healthcare or education, there doesn't seem to be any willingness among our legislature to talk to each other to find resolutions to these problems. But more importantly, not only is there a lack of willingness, there seems to be a lack of structural ability. We have a perfect storm of conditions in California that have combined to make the state absolutely ungovernable. We have a robust initiative process that the voters have adopted and usurped the legislature. And the initiative is a very clumsy way to legislate. Every civilized democracy in the world legislates the same way. An idea is proposed, it gets written up as a bill, it goes through committee process, it's amended, it's debated, and the worst unintended consequences are peeled off, and it's moderated quite often from the original idea, and it becomes law. The initiative process works in exactly the opposite way. The original idea is not up for debate, it's not up for discussion, it's not up for amendment, and it's the side that can shout and yell the loudest that generally gets their way, and that tends to be the special interest with the deepest pocket. And that's how we legislate in California. It's dysfunctional, it's broken. And that's just one. I mean, term limits, again, Senator Brilty is absolutely correct. Term limits have given us ideologically a combined circumstance of term limits and our electoral process have given us ideologically extreme legislators who are beholden to those special interests who hold a gun to their heads back in their districts. And all of this dysfunction is enshrined in our Constitution. If there's one single place you can point your finger and say this is where the dysfunction originates, it's in our Constitution.
And we're going to talk about a possible solution to that in the second half. Dr. Hernandez, then Mark Baldessari, and then Joel Fox.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Bob Hertzberg said in relationship to what the opportunities are to devolve decision-making into local jurisdictions. And, you know, caveat being San Francisco is a unique local jurisdiction. But just take a case in point where you could sit with business, as in large business, the Chamber, the Bay Area Council, as well as small business leaders, as well as advocates for people who are seeking services. We sat a table of about 35 people to try to figure out how to reach 85,000 uninsured in the city. And it was we had tried it under Frank Jordan as mayor, as under Willie Brown as mayor, and labor was at the table in force, but business was also at table in force, as were the executive leaders of all the major delivery systems for healthcare. So it included UC and San Francisco General, but Sutter and CHW, et cetera. And so what was really striking to me in that was the ability to sit down in a room and have a conversation where small businesses would say, actually, look, I have no margin. If you charge, if I have to pay more per employee, this is what happens. It actually put their information directly on the table. And advocates having a direct conversation with people who run major enterprises, which in the Bay Area, I mean, healthcare is the biggest enterprise and will likely be. If there will be a boom, it will be what we get out of stem cell research. Where's the new wealth of California? That's likely where it's going to come from. And so I think the ability to have a common ground, trusted conversation to say, how do you take existing public dollars, as well as a system that is completely chaotic, in the case here, the safety net system, and make it work for everybody?
What allowed that to work? Why couldn't that happen in Sacramento?
Well, you know, it's a much smaller room. And you could name all the special interests, really. Healthcare providers, all the primary care folks who get FQHC dollars from the feds. I mean, you actually could bring them in the room. And frankly, most of them have had relationships over a long period of time with one another. And there was a general sense of we can make this work without a whole lot of new money. And we had a tremendous amount of empiric data that people trusted, which largely came from the philanthropic sector. But I do think that devolving much more of the problem solving for what we need in communities into communities where there is more trust because you've worked with them on this issue or on that issue successfully, I actually think that that is something in getting to a fix. We have to really think about how we do that.
Mark.
I just want to come back to something that a question you'd asked earlier, Scott, which has been sort of a running theme through a lot of these conversations, and that has to do with the perception of special interests in Sacramento today. And from a public opinion polling perspective, there's never been a time when there are as many people as there are today saying that things in Sacramento are mainly run by special interests rather than for the benefits of the average people. And what does that mean
exactly?
That's
because the voters are insightful. They get it.
It means that people feel powerless. They also feel distrustful of what's taking place in the legislative process and the interactions between a governor and legislature around a Big Five meeting or whatever it is. This is important for two reasons. It's important for the reason that if you're going to ask the people for something through the legislative process, like to raise their taxes or to change something or other, they're going to approach it from the point of view of, first of all, that they don't really have power, somebody else does, and this decision might not be in their best interest. It also means, though, I mean, and here's the difference, you know, really today from perhaps what things were like during other reform eras in California, that things have gotten so complicated for people in Sacramento, they're so distrustful, that if they see a reform, they're going to wonder about, as they did with term limits, whose interest is this? Why is the Bay Area Council behind the Constitutional Convention, right? There may be perfectly good and, you know, civic-oriented reasons, but people are going to approach it from the point of, is there some kind of special interest gamesmanship that's going on?
So it's a fundamental lack of trust.
And who is in California forward? You know, so these are the kinds of questions, you know, people feel we have a system that's not transparent, it's not accountable, it's operating for somebody else. And this, I think, is why, you know, the idea of bringing things down to the local level is a comforting one for people, because that's a level at which they understand, they feel like they have some kind of control or power for, they can identify the actors, whether they like them or not, they know them, they see them.
And keep an eye on them.
Yeah.
Joel.
Let me put in a good word for the initiative process and a defense of the initiative process and the people who in the majority of California seem to support it. And that doesn't mean that I don't think there should be some reforms to the process, and there can be. In fact, Speaker Hertzberg put me on a commission a few years back on reforms in the initiative process, and I did support some of the reforms that came forward in that report. The report, like many others out of the commissions, ended up on a shelf and nothing happened to it. However, I've been on six commissions. I don't think anything's happened with any of them. Bob Stern, who runs the Center for Government Studies, and you've probably had him on your show, Scott, a number of times, asked the question, how many initiatives would the voters change their mind on now that they voted on in the past? And he comes up with one or two because he thinks the voters have been fairly consistent and logical in a lot of the decisions they've made at the polls. And if it's true, and the argument that we've heard around the table that Matt just made, that I made in my initial comments, that the special interests have a lot of influence in Sacramento, then isn't then the initiative process a natural outlet for folks who are frustrated to make a change or try to find and seek some reforms? And I think this gets back to the idea that we have to understand that we have two electorates here in California, one that's filtered through the legislature and the legislative body makes decisions, and then the voters themselves are an electorate when they go to the polls and make their own legislature, in effect, by making decisions on ballot measures. And those two electorates don't agree on a number of subjects. You can name a whole bunch of things. I would argue the one I'm most familiar with, of course, with the Prop 13. The legislature in 1978 and the legislature today, neither one would pass Prop 13. The voters passed it overwhelmingly in 1978, and Mark's polls will indicate that they would pass it overwhelmingly today. And there are a whole series of examples you can find. So the question is, how do we bring those two electorates to more of a like mind? I absolutely agree with Jim's analysis on the results of this redistricting effort. Good idea. Maybe on the margins something happens on one or two seats, but generally that's not going to be the answer.
Dr. Gibbs.
Yeah, I'd really like to take a slightly different point of view than Joel Fox just presented about the initiatives. I actually agree with Matt Reagan. It's really one of the most unwieldy way of making laws. You know, I come from New England, where we used to have small villages where people would meet, and 200 or 300 people would have direct democracy. This is a state of over 30 million people. You really cannot have direct democracy like you have in a New England village. You really have to have a legislature that makes laws and to represent the will of the people. And I think that as we go forward, we really also need to realize the state is much more diverse. And very often, the propositions that are passed represent only one group in the state and don't represent all the various minority constituencies.
But how do you change that?
Well, wait a minute. I want to use education as an example to go to kind of tie two ideas together. I agree that local legislation is good, and I think often in communities where people are willing to pass taxes, you find better schools, you find better services. But we have a state where there are certain state functions, which include social services, education, higher education and education, crime, and so forth. These cannot be regulated on a local level. And we are looking at a state which once had the finest educational system in the world. And because of a dysfunctional legislature, we now are, as I said, ranked very low in the, you know, final last 10 of the states in almost every single measure. And now we've cut over $800 million for this our fine state university. 2 years ago, the University of California was ranked the best research university in the world by the Higher Education Times of London. This year, it's ranked 39th because of the things that have happened. And it's, so in 2 years, who is responsible for funding the University of California? And this is also the engine, the educational engine, that that helps the state to produce scientists, technologists, all kinds of people with skills, in Silicon Valley, for example. And what we are destroying, not only the University of California and its 10 campuses, but the state system, the state university system, and even the community colleges. We have overcrowded classrooms. We have old lab, science labs. We have faculty who are leaving to go to places like the University of Texas. We have staff who are demoralized. An 8% cut at the University of California for staff and faculty. What I'm saying is this has to be done at the state level. And so to make my final point, when are we going to have people realize, both in the legislature and the citizens of this state who don't want to pay taxes, that you cannot have fine services at a high level. You cannot have good roads. You cannot have good schools. You cannot have good social services. You cannot have good libraries unless you have some kind of taxes to support them. And I think this is one of the major dysfunctions right now in the state.
Okay, we're going to take a break, but I want to get a few quick points in. I think Senator Brilton wants to speak, and
first,
then Speaker Hertzberg.
2 points. The voters of this state have shown a great willingness to raise taxes, both at the state level and the local level, whenever they feel that they're getting bang for their buck, when they feel that it's being spent efficiently and effectively. The voters of this state have shown time and time again they're willing to raise taxes. In defense of the initiative process, we've talked about two initiatives. You mentioned three strikes, and Joel, of course, can't show up without mentioning Prop 13.
That's why they bring me here.
In both cases, the voters chose that outlet because the legislature failed to deal with a core problem. In 1974, Ronald Reagan had a property tax reform. The voters ultimately rejected. But Ronald Reagan had a property tax reform because people had trouble with property taxes. This was a problem that the legislature ignored for almost a decade. And the voters finally said, enough. You're not doing your job. We're going to do it. And so we got Prop 13. During the late 80s and the early 90s, voters said, we want tougher criminal justice laws. The legislature refused to deal with that. And, you know, I happened to be there. It was fascinating. The legislature refused to pass tougher laws, and it wasn't until three strikes was qualified that the legislature then said, oh, we ought to have a different alternative. And by then, the voters said no.
Well, in some states, when that happened, the legislature does get an opportunity.
I understand that, but my point is I wasn't around 100 years ago, but I think the reformers were not unsophisticated. I think the voters, by and large, get it right. I think they're a great deal more sophisticated than most people think that they are. And the initiative process, there are abuses to it. But by and large, I think the voters get it right. Even when I disagree with them, I think they get it right more.
Does it trouble you at all that the electorate doesn't really reflect who lives here?
Does it trouble me from a political point of view, from a personal point of view? I don't know. I mean, you're the academic. Ask me, is a high voter turnout somehow more beneficial, more ethical, more moral than an informed voter turnout? I don't know. I'd argue that an informed voter turnout is what we should want. A high voter turnout doesn't mean
much. So that assumes that people who don't vote regularly are uninformed?
No, it doesn't. I think a lot of people that don't vote get it more than most people think they do. I mean, one of the problems, I think, is we have overlapping jurisdictions of government. You go to the local school district and say, hey, my kid's not learning anything, and they say it's those people in the legislature. Go blame them. You go to the legislature, say, well, we have a local school district. I think there's a whole segment of our population that doesn't vote, not because they're apathetic. I don't think they can figure out who to reward and punish.
Well,
and when you let them know who's in charge and they get to reward and they get to punish, I mean, they do a pretty good job of it. But it's
hard. To have a law that required 30 days, and people who are, often move within 30 days and find out as soon as campaign starts getting focused, you go to register and you can't register. We changed the law when you were there to 15 days. But, I think we should have like a quorum law like you got in corporate law. You don't have enough members around the table of the board of directors. You can't take action. There's got to be a minimum threshold. I know it has a lot of implications, but I just don't think these elections, that these turnouts are so small, have a moral legitimacy. I live in a community that next Tuesday is an election. I think the turnout will be 2 or 3% of the people that actually live there. It's just mind-numbing, and we call ourselves a democracy. It's painful. I just wanted to go to the issue of the initiatives on the practical side for a moment. And look, here's the bottom line. We've got a problem. We've got to fix it. Right now, as Mr. Baldessari says, nobody trusts government. Next case. When I was in the legislature, we had 54%, or when we were in the legislature together, we had 54% approval rating. It's now 10%. I've seen it below that. There is no way the public is going to turn and say, oh, we're going to give up our power and give you more power. Whether it is accurate or inaccurate, the ability to work on initiative reform, in my judgment, during these difficult times is a non-starter. There is no way the public is going to say, oh, I feel horrible, blah, 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 but I'm going to give up my power and give more power to you. This is not the time for that discussion. We've got a fire in the room. We've got to put it out. We've got to deal with some fundamentals in terms of fixing the place, whether that's blowing it up in a constitutional convention to a reset, whether that's California Forward's approach or whatever. But I just think as a practical matter, as however frustrating it is and however rational a discussion is around initiative reform, it is the wrong time to ask people to give up their power when they don't trust anything of what's happening in the state.
Bob Hertzberg of the group California Forward, who used to represent Los Angeles in the state assembly. In the second half of this program, we'll talk about proposals for a constitutional convention. You're listening to a special California Governance Roundtable, a presentation of the California Report. You can find the complete version of our conversation on California governance online. Just go to californiareport.org. In the second half of our conversation, we started talking about some of the proposals out there to reform California government, specifically a proposal for a constitutional convention. We'll hear from former State Senator Jim Brulte, Joel Fox of the Small Business Action Committee, Mark Baldessari of the Public Policy Institute of California, former State Assemblyman Bob Hertzberg, and first up, Matt Reagan of the Bay Area Council. That's the group leading the Constitutional Convention initiative, Repair California. We should mention that since this roundtable took place, Repair California put its efforts on hold for lack of funds.
We've spent the best part of the last hour highlighting the many ills that California currently suffers, and there are many. As I commented earlier, I think you can find the source of most of these ills in our Constitution. It's the third longest constitution in the world after India and Alabama. It's been amended over 500 times. We've dubbed it the Winchester Mystery House of Constitutions, and it's by and large due to 100-plus years of conflicting initiatives that have given us this wieldy or rather unwieldy document. We feel that the problems are systemic in nature, and that it will require a systemic, holistic solution to fix them, which is why we think a constitutional convention gives us that vehicle and that possibility. We're proposing that the Constitution be opened in a limited way. We would firewall off all of the social issues that tend to soak up a lot of heat but don't generate much light. Marriage, guns, prayer in school, all of that stuff, not part of the discussion, and limit the Constitutional Convention just to those issues that relate to how we govern ourselves as Californians. And those issues have been discussed at length. And we think that our polling has shown, much as Mark's polling has shown, that the people of California only trust themselves, really, to fix the problem. And a Constitutional Convention comprised of everyday Californians that looks like California could potentially give us that vehicle and that opportunity. I think if you look back at the other solution available to us is the initiative process, which we have discussed. And if you look at the origins of the initiative process, it was given to us by Hiram Johnson in the Progressive Era, when California had a population of just over 750,000 people, so it was possible for a group of well-intentioned, civic-minded citizens to get together and defeat a powerful special interest in Sacramento. We now have 37 million residents in California, so it's the tool that Hiram Johnson gave us to defeat the special interest is now only available to the special interests because it costs so much money to qualify an initiative for the ballot. So we believe that in order to keep that civic or that public participation in governance with the people, but firewall off and keep the special interests out of the discussion or out of rather than running the discussion, that a constitutional convention gives us both those possibilities.
But couldn't you also end up with a document that would be worse?
That's quite possible, and we're fully aware that is a possibility, though many would argue that how could you possibly make the California Constitution any worse than it currently is? There it is a possibility, but we believe we're in a point in our state's history that we have to take a bit of a chance. Every metric that states are judged by, California ranks last. Last in public education, we have the most congested traffic in the country. We elect ideologically extreme legislators who can't talk to each other. We have a water system that's a small earthquake away from rendering 50% of California uninhabitable. All of these major issues that face the state, we can't fix through current vehicles and current avenues. So we feel that we have to take a little bit of a flyer, and this looks like the way that the opportunity that might get us.
Can I ask just a couple of questions? Sure. Because I think about this constitutional convention back and forth. I think I'm disinclined to be supportive, but you know, a couple centuries ago, our founding fathers called a constitutional convention, and it was very, very limited in scope. And then they got there and they decided, well, we're going to change, and they threw out the entire structure of government. And actually, they did a pretty good job because they created a system that any idiot could run, and idiots have. If you believe the argument that the initiative process is only open to the special interests, and the initiative process is ultimately adjudicated by the voters in a vote. How do you do an entire constitutional convention, which ultimately has to go to the voters for a vote, and say, well, the special interests are going to be eliminated from it? I mean, if a small problem with a specific initiative is now captive of the special interest, how do you say the entire state? We're going to wall them off and they're not going to be able to participate. It just strikes me that logic dictates that's not a rational position.
But it's a very different dynamic. If you look at how the initiative process works, it's a 30-day election cycle by and large. That's when people start spending their money and stuffing our mailboxes with junk, mostly lies and half-truths, and flooding our TV screens when we're trying to watch football. An initiative, or rather a constitutional convention, is a very different dynamic. It would be an 8-month likely convention. It would be editorialized. It would be blogged. It would be online. It would be televised. And the voters would get a mature, civilized discussion about the issues rather than the standard yelling match that the initiative process gives us.
Mark Baldessari, you've been polling on these kinds of things.
Yeah, and I haven't polled specifically on the measures that will be on the ballot in November should, you know, it go through the signature process and make it to the ballot, which seems at this point is a likely prospect. But I do want to say one thing, which is that, you know, we're focused here on the end game. And I just want to say that I'm more focused on what's going to happen next year and how this is going to be perceived by the voters in the current context. And in order for there to be a constitutional convention, and I think you would agree with this, we have to go and change the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so you are part of the initiative process.
Yeah. Now. No, we fully recognize
and
the
as,
irony
and
of
as
that.
And as part of the initiative process, which the voters in concept think is a great thing because they have a voice, they will be looking at whoever it is that is bringing this to them after the signatures have been gathered as what interest is it? Is it something like a Prop 13 sort of thing where it's a populist measure? Is this a business group? Is this a union group? Is this Democrats? Is this Republicans? And this is why I tend to discount polling prior to elections because depending upon who is in favor and against this, it, given especially in this context of distrust, it's very easy to move people in one direction or another if there's any sense that it's some interest that's driving this. And often what's most successful from the standpoint of what are the voters likely to support is if business and labor and Democrats and Republicans, and there is an element of a greater public interest involved, then the voters say, okay, well, this is different from the standard things that are coming to the ballot. So that this is and this is for – it's not just for the Bay Area Council's efforts next year. It's for anybody who's thinking about going to the voters and saying, yeah, we agree with you. It's time for a change, and this is what we want to do. Because the voters, they'll take another step, which is, well, you know, who wants this change and why?
Speaker Herzberg, your group's taking a different tack.
Yeah, that is exactly it. And it's the reason why when Leon Panetta went off to the CIA and I was offered the opportunity to co-chair, I chose to do it because it is a different tack, because it is exactly what Mark Baldessari says. It is an unbelievably unique opportunity of the Hewlett Foundation and the Packard Foundation and the California Endowment and James Irvine Foundation and the Haas Foundation said, enough. We spend millions of dollars every year to try to fix the problems. And Senator Brulte was referring to the budget and what's going on. It's exactly what's happening. How do we really achieve the problems? Let's put together a nonpartisan group of people. They put $30 million commitment that is unprecedented and said, let's fund this group for 5 years and let's see if we can come up with some practical solutions to solve the problem. And then the group did something also that was unique, that wasn't ivory tower and wasn't out there to try to reinvent the world and to create some new concept. They went back and dusted off every one of those old reports that Joel Fox talked about, and they looked at every smart idea that ever came out. And they've been to 45 and soon 58 counties and talked to more than 40,000 people. And then they polled and repolled and refocus grouped and went and talked to more people at every corner of the state to marry this concept of getting best practices, nothing that's new and too fancy, nothing that really scares people, but what are the real cornerstone problems, talking to the best and the brightest everywhere, talking to ordinary folks in all corners of the state, conducting forums and seminars and symposiums where people had opportunity to voice their concerns, married that with these concepts and come up with best practices. And then and also a real deliverable approach that says what's real. And what we came up with, we started with three propositions. We're down to two, but we're going to support the third. The first is fix the budget. Stop the IOUs. Stop the madness. Get some sanity around the process and fix the budget in a nonpartisan way that reduces the threshold to 50% plus one so the majority is accountable, but puts in very real and very strict, intelligent, two-year budgeting, results-based budgeting, pay-go systems in the process. Two, stop the war between state and locals where there's a fight of accountability that was referred to earlier, of everybody pointing fingers as to who does what. Devolve power closer to the people where people do have more trust and confidence. They may not know exactly everything, but it's a start of where to move the state so it can be agile on the one hand and more representative on the other. And third was this 12-year term limits that was referred to by Dan and Senator Brulte earlier. But a coalition of labor and business came together in Los Angeles, chose to do exactly the same thing. We have no pride in authorship. As they say in Yiddish, alavai, go for it, put it, and they'll do it, and that's great. And that was the starting point because that's about as much as we thought we could get done given the temperament and given the concern of people have, whether it's losing their homes or their jobs and all of the stuff that they do. Best practices, nonpartisan, you know, approach, and then we're going to come back in 2012 and take a next step.
Dan Schnerdy, is it possible to put good government on the ballot and expect it's really going to have a chance?
I think it is, and I know we were all throwing javelins at Matt a couple minutes ago. But I think whether it comes out of a constitutional convention or whether it comes out of the kind of process that Bob Hertzberg was just describing, the key for any ballot initiative, and this goes back to Mark Baldessari's point, is credibility. And as someone referenced earlier in this conversation, voters tend to find something credible when they see unlikely allies coming together for it. When you see business and labor, when you see Democrats and Republicans saying, look, we disagree on most things, but here's something that we can agree is important, that's the kind of thing that provides a legitimate foundation for passing an initiative, whether it's a policy reform or a political process reform. The difficulty is, as Joel was talking about earlier, is it's much easier to beat an initiative than it is to pass one. And if you look back over California political history, what you see is that ballot initiatives that have any money spent against them, not necessarily initiatives that are outspent, but initiatives of any money spent against them at all, tend to lose. Why? Because voters might not like their current situation, but they can be very easily convinced that what this dastardly initiative might do is even worse. Yeah. So the odds are against it. The odds are against it regardless of the starting point that either Bob or Matt has talked about. But if it's going to be done, it's going to be done with a coalition of unlikely allies that, number one, can give credibility to the voters, and number two, silence the likely guns of opposition.
Just to back up what Dan Joel said, Fox. In the 1960s, it was Ronald Reagan and Jesse Unruh, leaders of their two respective parties, who came together on the last constitutional reforms.
Mark Baldessari, the surveys that you have done time and again, and there's another one coming out soon, what difference does it make that voters have this deep sense of distrust?
Well, it makes a huge difference in terms of what they're willing to accept that's coming out of Sacramento. I think we saw the clearest example that I've seen maybe in my polling lifetime in the special election where voters overwhelmingly, I mean, not just by a small margin, and it wasn't this wasn't just a case of, well, it was who voted, because in our polling it was all the voters said, you know, the things coming out of there in terms of the decisions that they're making, it can't be right. And this is the challenge. I mean, this is a challenge not just for governing but for changing government at this point, that who is the messenger and what is the deal behind the reforms that is going to present a tremendous challenge in 2010 for anyone, whether they're leaders, in the executive branch, in the legislative branch, or average citizens that are putting things forward, that there is this great fear that underneath all of this, you know, decisions are being made for the wrong reason today in Sacramento. And the fact that we don't have the kind of news coverage of Sacramento that we have of Washington, D.C., or of what's going on in people's city councils or local government makes it all the more difficult to break through that distrust of what's going on in state government. We thought that with somebody who had the stature, the stage presence of Arnold Schwarzenegger, that there would be an opportunity to communicate with voters in a way that would be new and different. For a while, that seemed to be the case. But, you know, by 2005, that had all fallen apart in terms of the governor's ability.
In our final excerpt, our guests discussed how California's diverse population could affect political reform efforts. Leading off, Mark Baldessari of the Public Policy Institute of California, then Joel Fox, Dr. Sandra Hernandez of the San Francisco Foundation, former Republican political consultant Dan Schnur, Bob Hertzberg of California Forward, and Professor Jewel Taylor Gibbs of UC Berkeley.
With all the demographic change that has occurred in California, people still perceive the future as having to do with having good education, having a good infrastructure, having a college-educated workforce, and you have to connect the dots for the voters between, you know, the investments that are being made in schools, you know, older white voters, with what we need in our schools that are going to provide the kind of workforce that leads to an economy where you have tax revenues coming in. But people make that connection. They do. And that's why I believe that Californians will continue to support investments that are going to lead to a better economy. And part of that is having educating our children, bringing up the immigrant groups in California, raising the education levels, all part of the state's future.
Yeah. Joel Fox, did you want to say something?
I'm not a big fan of identity politics. You know, groups all particularly going to vote a certain way or another. I think the core, we talk about people of color here with the professor, but I think the core color is green, meaning the taxation dollars that come in and how they're spent. I opened with my comment about how taxation is the essence of government, and I believe we solve the problems the professor brings up if we have a more business-friendly California, comment that's been made here before, I believe, by the senator, because that creates jobs for the community and it creates revenue for government. And I think that is one of the solutions that we don't pay enough attention to in this state.
You know, Scott, I sit here as a physician who spent a lot of my career in government doing public health work. And it seems to me that in all of this, you know, I think Mark has spoken very eloquently to how do we get more civic engagement, more in-depth understanding of what the problems are, not just what people are dissatisfied about and not just what they want to see, but actually is it California Forward's remedies or is it a convention remedies? And if you're trying to change behavior, whether it's, you know, the general electorate and people who are eligible to vote to participate to make governance better, and that's a thesis that I hold, then there is investment that you have to make in the next generation to have them be knowledgeable enough about the history of the initiative process, about the history of the Constitution, about the demographics of the state. And we have a lot of work to do to build that kind of civic knowledge, to be able to be a good member of a constitutional convention if you get charged or picked at large to do that. And I think both of these campaigns are necessary to keep saying, actually, we need structural reform. But I also think both of them need much deeper grassroots work at understanding that a large part of our communities across the state, whether they're in Orange County or in the Bay Area, really are not at a place where they can fully participate in being part of the solution. And I don't think we can impose solution from the top down, no matter how well-intended it is in any particular reform effort.
If I can build off of Dr. Hernandez's point, it seems to me we've been having two very fascinating but parallel conversations here. One about government and political reform, whether it's through a constitutional convention, whether it's term limits, whether it's redistricting, whether it's a majority budget passage, and an equally important conversation about education and about health care and about job creation and about tax revenue. And it seems to me the challenge for this discussion going forward, toward Dr. Hernandez's point, particularly for people regardless of their demographic or ideological status, is to marry those two conversations together and be able to explain to them why structural and political and government change is going to have some material impact on their children's education, on their ability to start a small business and create jobs, on their ability to protect the environment, on their ability to provide for public safety, and so on. And I worry that as long as the conversations continue on two separate tracks, you can't tap into the grassroots energy that you need in order to make the structural reform, in order to make the policy change.
No, you know, catch something, you're exactly right. I mean, what are reading scores under these performance standards that you asked for in terms of your kids, and how can you determine the reading scores? What is the dropout rate? Very definable, specific deliverables for people. You got to get off of the high horse of government reform and into how does this affect my life and why will these changes beyond these things that we talk about? No one knows about term limits, or they don't even know what Sacramento is, or and don't want to know. But it's really about, will these things affect my life in some way that's positive? And that will be something that we're working on. And all of these kinds of things we've looked at from other states, the best practices, we have clearly at Pew, they've had examples, other places, very clear, demonstrable effects that this will make your life better.
Can you do that, though, without some kind of a transformational person, a leader at the top?
No.
You can't do that?
No.
Is that person out there?
We don't know yet. We'll find out over the next 11 months.
With that.
You know, I do want to say that, you know, in terms of what Mr. Hertzberg has just said, when you look at the students who have been out there protesting the increase in tuition at the University of California system, 32%, think about that in terms of your own children. And the fact is that a lot of the kids we want to educate really can't afford that.
That's right.
And so why are they being faced with this? It's because of the budget, and it's because the legislature has not been doing its job. So I do think people want to ask, do we have good roads? Do we have good schools? Do we have good health care? That's what they want to know. And they are less interested in the kind of mechanics of government than the delivery of government. And I think that whatever we can do in the state of California to deliver government better is what we need to be focusing on.
Jewel Taylor Gibbs is a professor emerita of social welfare at the University of California, Berkeley. And that's where we'll leave this discussion of California governance. Thanks to all of our panelists for joining us. You can find audio of the complete version of our roundtable online at californiareport.org. Our roundtable on California governance was recorded on December 4th, 2009, by David Ogilvie. The post-production engineer was Howard Gelman. The broadcast was edited by Nina Thorson. We had research assistance from Matthew Colley. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the members of KQED Public Radio.